Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month. This monthly cassette tape series represents yet another step in accomplishing Granting Associates' vision of helping the service contractor come to a place of maturity and profitability. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry shares dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. Have you ever noticed some people always seem to get a lower price on whatever they buy? Most of the time, that doesn't just happen by accident. Those kinds of people have mastered some of the basics of the art of negotiating. This month, Roger Dawson is going to share some really practical ideas on how to negotiate on a variety of fronts. Roger is no stranger to our longtime listeners. He's done several tapes before, and each one inspires new ways to get what you want at a price you believe to be fair. I know you're going to want to listen to this tape over and over. Oh, by the way, don't forget to sign up for Grandy & Associates' newest three-day business training program called the Basic Business Boot Camp. Response has been tremendous, and classes are filling up fast. Call and make your reservation today. There's a flyer enclosed with your tape.
In this session, we'll cover some more power negotiating gambits. This is the flinching gambit. Flinching says that you should always visually react anytime a proposal is made to you. Let's say that you're at a resort area, and here's one of these charcoal sketch artists doing the sketch. He doesn't have the price posted, has the shell sitting on the stool, and you say to him, "How much is the sketch?" He says, $15. If that doesn't appear to shock you, his next words will be, "And $5 extra for color." If you still don't seem shocked, he'll say, "And we have these shipping cartons. You'll need one of those, too." As opposed to with a flinch, "How much is the sketch?" $15.
$15, you say. "That's a lot of money."
And as you say it, you slap your cheek in surprise. He says, "Well, look, I'll tell you what I'll do. I normally charge $5 extra for the color, but for you, I'll throw it in at no extra charge."
"That's still a lot of money," you say.
He says, "Well, come here. I have never, ever done this before. But you're such a nice person, I'll not only throw in the color, I'll give you one of these shipping cartons, too." You see the difference? You see, people are watching for your response. Perhaps you have a spouse, and the last thing in the world they would ever do is flinch, because anything that theatrical is beneath their dignity. When I was married, my wife was like that. We'd walk into a store, and she'd say to the clerk, "How much is the coat?"
$2,000.
"That's not bad," she'd say. "I'm having a heart attack in the background." The point is that people are watching for your reaction. Now, you don't have to be as theatrical as I might be, but remember that any time a proposal is made to you, people are watching for your reaction. So don't disappoint them. You'll be amazed at what might happen. You see, when that general says to you, "You do understand that you get paid when I get paid, don't you?" They may not think for a moment that you'll go along with that. It's something that they threw out to see what your reaction would be. And if you don't react with a big flinch, they'll start thinking, "Well, maybe I will get them to go along with that. I never dreamed that they would, but they don't seem to be too shocked. I bet if I hang in there a little bit longer, I will get them to go along with it." It makes them tougher negotiators. Perhaps you're a general and the developer says to you, "Now, you will take care of any plan review changes, won't you?" They may not think for a moment that you'll agree to that. It's just something they threw out to see what your reaction would be. And if you don't seem too shocked or surprised, they'll start thinking, "Perhaps they've done that in the past and are willing to do it again. I never dreamt that they would, but I'm going to push the point. Maybe I will get them to do it." It makes them tougher negotiators. And the people who study this kind of thing, the body language experts, say that as much as 80% of the impression that you give people when you're negotiating with them is what they see, not what they hear you saying. The visual overrides the auditory. I call that the Oliver North rule. In spite of the fact that he admitted to lying to Congress, to sharing secret documents, to taking kickbacks from contractors, in spite of all this, he became a national hero overnight. Because the visual impression that he gave of a super patriot charging up a hill somewhere to defend his country was so overwhelming. People remember what they see. They don't remember what they hear. Here's the trade-off gambit. Trading off says that any time you're asked for a concession in the negotiations, automatically ask for something in return. If you just pick up on this one gambit, the first time you use it, you'll get back the money you invested in this program, and it'll pay off for you thousands of dollars every year from this point on. Let's say that you're a general, and a sub calls you up and says, "Look, we're a little bit behind on our schedule here. We promised you that we'd be ready to go October the 1st, but it's going to be 2 weeks late. We won't be able to get to you until October the 15th. Now, it may be in this particular situation you know that you're not going to need them until November the 1st. But even though your initial inclination is to say, that's fine, I still want you to use the trade-off. I want you to say, quite frankly, I don't know whether we can go along with October the 15th or not. I'll have to check with my scheduling people and see what they say about it. But let me ask you this. If we can do that for you, what can you do for us?" Now, one of three things is going to happen here. Number one, you might just get something. They may just have been thinking, boy, we got a problem here. What can we give them as an incentive to get them to go along with this delay? So they may just concede something to you. If it's the electrical sub, they may just say, if you'll go along with that, I won't charge you for running that temporary wiring to the site. Secondly, you've elevated the value of the concession. When you're negotiating, why give anything away? Always make a big deal out of it. You may need that later on. Later on, you may need to be able to go to them and say, "Do you remember last October when you couldn't perform on time? You know how hard I had to talk to my people to get them to go along with that extension? Now look, we did that for you. I want you to do this for us." So you set it up as a trade-off later on. And the third thing that happens is it stops the grinding away process. If they know that every time they ask you for something, you're going to ask for something in return, then it stops them constantly coming back for more. I can't tell you how many times a contractor has said to me, "Roger, can you help me with this? We thought we had a sweetheart of a deal put together. We didn't think that we would have any problems at all with this one. But in the very early stages, they asked us for a small concession. We said, sure, we can do that. A week later, they called us for another small concession, and we said, all right, I guess we can do that too. Ever since then, it's been one darn thing after another. Now it looks like the whole thing is going to fall apart on us. They should have known up front that when they were asked for that first small concession, they should have asked for something in return. If we can do that for you, what can you do for us?" This is the vice gambit. This is a way of squeezing people's expectations with a very simple little expression. You'll be amazed at what the vice gambit will get you. Here's the way it works. Anytime a proposal is made to you, you smile sweetly, push it back across the desk, and you say, "I'm sorry, you'll have to do better than that." Now, a power negotiator will automatically respond with the counter tactic, which is, "Exactly how much better than that do I have to do?" Trying to pin you down to a specific. But you'll be amazed how often inexperienced negotiators will concede a big chunk of their negotiating range simply because you said that. School teachers use the vice when they don't have time to grade papers. They'll send them back to the kids with a note attached that says, "You'll have to do better than this." The interesting thing is they always come back better. There's always room for improvement from the other side. So try that simple expression, "You'll have to do better than that." Don't forget the counter gambit when it's used on you. "Exactly how much better than that do I have to do?" I taught power negotiating to the executives from a large company based in Jacksonville, Florida. A couple of weeks after the seminar, they called me up and said, "Roger, we thought you'd like to know that we just made $14,000 with one of the gambits that you taught us at the seminar. We're having our Miami office completely outfitted with new telephone equipment. I decided which bid I wanted to accept, and when I got back from the seminar, I was going to okay it and mail it back to them. But then I thought, what have I got to lose? So I scrawled across it, 'You'll have to do better than this,' and mailed it back to them. Their counterproposal came back $14,000 less than I was prepared to pay them." Okay, so you may be thinking, "Roger, you didn't tell us whether that was a $50,000 telephone system, in which case it would have been a major, major concession, or whether it was a $500,000 system, in which case it wouldn't have been that big a deal." Don't fall into the trap of negotiating percentages instead of dollars. The point was that he made $14,000 in the 2 minutes that it took him to scrawl that counterproposal across the bid, which meant that while he was doing it, he was generating $420,000 per hour of bottom-line profits. That's pretty good money, isn't it? Don't negotiate percentages. It doesn't make any sense for one of your salesmen to come back to you and say, "We got the job. I had to make a $10,000 concession, but it's a $200,000 job." Here's the real issue. There was $10,000 sitting in the middle of the table. Somebody was going to pick it up. How long would you want one of your salesmen to keep on negotiating to make $10,000 of bottom-line profits? If you're like most contractors I've met, you'll say, "As long as it takes." Realize the importance of the fact that when you're negotiating bottom-line profits. If you're able to bring 5% of your gross sales down to the bottom line as net-net profits, that $10,000 concession has the same impact on your bottom line as an additional $200,000 sale. How long should a salesman be willing to spend to get a $200,000 sale? As long as it takes, right? So power negotiators mentally calculate how much is sitting in the middle of the table and how long it might take to negotiate it. Obviously, it doesn't make any sense for you to spend half an hour negotiating a $20 item. That means you'd be making $40 an hour, and you can do better than that. Whether they're right or whether they're wrong, you're better off to pull a $20 bill out of your pocket and lay it up on the counter. So figure out what your time is worth, estimate the potential profit from the negotiation and how long it will take you to get it, and calculate how much money you'd be making on a per-hour basis. I think you'll agree with me when you think that way, that when you're negotiating, you're making more money faster than anything else you can do. To put this in perspective for you, for every $100,000 you put in your pocket at the end of the year, your time is worth about $50 an hour. Whenever what you're doing is making more than $50 an hour, you're improving the situation. Anytime what you're doing generates less than $50 an hour, you're hurting the situation. And I say to you that when you're power negotiating, you're not making $50 an hour. You're making $50 a minute or $50 a second. Power negotiating is the highest and best use of your time. The power of the printed word. Remember when I told you that my daughter came to me for the $1,200 spending money for Europe? She showed me the recommended amount in writing. What chance would she have had of getting the full $1,200 if she'd have just told me about it? You see, people believe what they see in writing, even though they won't believe when they just hear about it. The Canon camera people did a stunt to prove that a number of years back. You may remember seeing it on television. They posted a sign on a freeway back east that said, "Delaware closed." Alan Funt stood by the sign in a rented trooper's uniform. He wasn't allowed to speak to the people as they came up, only point up at the sign. And it was amazing what was happening. People were coming to a screeching halt and saying things like, "How long is it going to be closed for? My wife and kids are inside." People believe what they see in writing. That's why I'm such a big believer in presentation binders. When you sit down with someone and you open up the presentation binder and it says, "My company is the greatest building contractor in the world," then you turn another page and it says, "Our workers are the greatest craftsmen in the business." You turn another page and start showing them reference letters from all your previous jobs, and it is believable even when they know you just came from the print shop with it. This is how hotels are able to get people to check out of their rooms on time. Holiday Inns used to have a terrible time getting people to check out of their room at 12 o'clock until they learned the art of the printed word and posted those little signs on the back of the door. Now, 97% of the people check out of the rooms on time without any question at all because the written word is believable. So every chance you get, put things in writing. If you have salespeople selling the jobs for you, for example, and you have to put a price change into effect, be sure that they have it in writing. Because there's a world of difference between them sitting with a potential customer and saying, "Look, we're having a price increase at the start of next month, so you should make a commitment now." And them saying, "Look at this letter I just got from my boss. Indicates that we're having a price increase on July 1st. Always show it to people in writing every chance you get. If you as a contractor don't have a method of creating computer-generated proposals, I'd suggest that you stop everything and go get one right now. It'll pay for itself on the first job. I had three contractors bid on fire damage work at my home. Two of them scrawled out bids by hand. They both bid around $24,000. The third contractor prepared a very comprehensive bid by computer. Every little detail was spelled out. But his bid was $49,000, over twice as much. I was able to get the insurance company to accept the higher bid. The power of the printed word was so great that I just didn't trust the handwritten bids. This is the withdrawn offer gambit. It's very, very effective for drawing the negotiations to a conclusion. And you use it when you get in that situation where you just feel the people are arm wrestling with you. You know that the general wants to use you, but you just know that at this point in time, they're arm wrestling for a better price. Or you know that the owner wants you to do the job, but they're thinking, how much would I be making per hour if I spent a little more time negotiating? First of all, you have to understand that you may have made the mistake of setting up a pattern in the way that you've negotiated. Let's say that you've bid a small change order at $3,000. The actual cost of the change is $1,000, so you might be thinking that your negotiating range could allow you to give away up to $1,000 and still be making money on the change order. The way in which you give away that $1,000 is very, very critical. We all have a tendency to want to give away the smallest concession we possibly can first and see what happens. So you might initially say, well, I might be able to squeeze another $100 out of the proposal, but that's about our limit. If they reject that, you might think, this isn't going to be as easy as I thought. So you offer another $200. Then you give away another $300, and then you've got $400 left in your negotiating range, and you give them the whole thing. You see what you've done there? You've started with a small concession, and you built up to a larger concession. You'll never bring the negotiations to a conclusion doing that, because every time they ask you for a concession, it just gets better and better for them. The best way to do it is to offer a reasonable concession up front that might just cinch the deal. Maybe a $500 concession wouldn't be out of line, half of your negotiating range. And be sure that if you have to make any future concessions, they're smaller and smaller. Your next concession might be $200, and then $100, and then $50. So you convince them by the reduced size of the concessions that you're making that they have pushed you about as far as you can be pushed. But power negotiators know how to do even better than that. Power negotiators know how to take away a concession that has already been granted. Let's say, for example, that the widget salesman comes in to see the contractor, and the salesperson wants a dollar for his widgets. The contractor offers 90 cents. They negotiate back and forth, and they finally arrive at 95 cents. Now what's going through the contractor's mind is, boy, I got him down from a dollar to 95 cents. I'll bet I can squeeze another penny out of him. I bet I can get him to go at 94 cents. So he says, look, business is really tough right now. I just can't do business with you on widgets unless you can bring the order in at 94 cents. To stop this grinding away process, the salesman says, I'm not sure if we can do that or not, but tell you what, if I can possibly get it for you, I will. That's good guy, bad guy. Let me go back, we'll refigure it and see if we can do it. I'll get back to you tomorrow. The next day he comes back and he pretends to withdraw the concession that he made the day before. He says, I'm really embarrassed about this, but we've been up all night refiguring the price of widgets. Somebody somewhere down the line has made a mistake. We know we were talking 95 cents yesterday, but we can't even sell it to you for that. 96 cents would be the lowest price that we could possibly offer you on widgets. What's the contractor's reaction? He's going to say, hey, wait a minute, buddy. We were talking 95 cents yesterday, and 95 cents is what I want. And immediately, 94 cents is forgotten. It's called withdrawing an offer to bring the negotiations to a conclusion. Let me give you another example on this because it's a very powerful negotiating gambit. Let's say that a group of friends have gone together and they've bought a home in the mountains to use for a vacation home. There's a whole group of them and have all gone in together on the cost of it and the expenses and they're sharing the use of it. One of the partners drops out of the syndication and your neighbor comes to you and tells you about the cabin in the mountains. Now, your initial reaction to this is, boy, this sounds fantastic. I'd love to do something like that. However, you're smart enough to play the reluctant buyer gambit, which we'll cover in detail in our next session together. You say, gee, I appreciate you telling me about that, but I don't think I'd be interested in that right now. I'm so busy, I don't think we'd have time to get up there anymore. But look, just to be fair to you, what is the very lowest price that you would sell a share in the home for? But he's been studying negotiating, too, and he's learned that you should never be the first one to name the price. So he says, quite frankly, we have a committee that decides on the price, the higher authority gambit, and I don't know what that price might be. I can take them a proposal, but I don't know what the reaction would be. When you press him a little bit more for the price, he finally says, I'm pretty sure that they're going to be asking $10,000. This is a lot less than you expected. You were willing to go to $15,000. And your initial reaction is to jump at it right away, but you're smart enough to remember to flinch. $10,000, you say? Oh, no, I could never go along with anything like that. That's way too much. Tell you what, I might be interested at $8,000. If they're interested at $8,000, let me know and we'll talk about it. The next day he comes back and he's decided to bring you into line by withdrawing the offer. He says, am I embarrassed about this? I know that we were talking $10,000 yesterday, but the committee decided last night that they wouldn't sell a share for less than $12,000. This is psychologically devastating to you. Number one, because you feel that you created the problem. You say, boy, I wish I'd never run into that Roger Dawson and his power of negotiating, because if I hadn't, I would have nailed him down at $10,000 yesterday. And secondly, you've made the mistake of telling your family all about it. They're all excited about the home up in the mountains, and you've passed that critical point in the negotiations where you're prepared to walk away. You say, Joe, what are you talking about? You said $10,000 yesterday, $12,000 today. Is it going to be $14,000 tomorrow? What's going on here? He says, I do feel badly, but that's what they, higher authority, decided. You say, Joe, come on. And he says, well, I do feel badly about this. Tell you what, let me go back to them one more time. Let me see what I can do for you with them. That's good guy, bad guy, isn't it? If I can get it for you for the $10,000, are you interested? And you say, of course I'm interested. I want it. And he's got you at full price. And you may not have realized what he's done to you until it's too late. Haven't we all at one time or another had an appliance salesperson or an automobile salesperson when we were trying to get that a little extra concession from them say, let me go to my sales manager and I'll see what I can do for you with him. And he comes back and he says, am I embarrassed about this? You know that advertised special we were talking about? I thought that ad was still in effect, but it went off last Saturday. I can't even sell it to you at the price we were talking about. And immediately you forget about future concessions and you want to jump on the bandwagon at the price you've been talking about. It's very effective. Here is the positioning for easy acceptance gambit. Very, very important, particularly if you're dealing with someone who's done some studying of negotiating. Very important that you set them up to make them feel good about giving in to you. Because sometimes someone has done some studying of negotiating and doesn't want to concede to you even when it's a win-win solution because they don't want to feel that they lost as a negotiator. So power negotiators know how to set them up to make them feel good about giving in to you. Let's say that you're an electrical subcontractor and you're negotiating with the general. You're only $5,000 apart on the job and you know that the general wants to use you. But it looks like the whole thing is going to fall apart on you and it's not the $5,000 that's the problem. The real problem is that the general's ego as a negotiator is on the line. He headed into the negotiations confident that he was going to do much better with you than he has, and he simply doesn't want to feel that he lost to you as a negotiator. So as a power negotiator, you've been smart enough to save a small concession that you can put on the table at this point to make him feel good about giving in to you. You say, Harry, we're only $5,000 apart on this thing. I can't budge an inch with my partners. Look, Harry, here's what I'm prepared to do for you. If you'll come up the $5,000, I won't charge you for running the temporary wiring to the site. Fair enough? That concession may be something that you were willing to do in the first place, but now you're courteous enough to position him so that he can say, okay, if you're willing to do that for me, I'll come up the $5,000. and he doesn't feel that he lost to you as a negotiator. Never, ever gloat. Never, ever, when you get through negotiating, say, Harry, you know, if you'd have hung in there a little bit longer, I was prepared to do this and this for you. Because Harry's going to say unkind things about your mommy when you do that. Always, when you're through negotiating, congratulate. However poorly you think the other person may have done in the negotiations, congratulate. Say, boy, did you do a fantastic job negotiating that. I realize that I didn't get as good a deal as I could have done, but quite frankly, it was worth it because I learned so much about negotiating. You were brilliant. You want the other person to feel that they won in the negotiations. Have you ever watched attorneys down at the courthouse? They'll cut each other to ribbons inside the courtroom, but outside you'll see the district attorney go up to the defense attorney and say, boy, were you brilliant in there. You really were. True, your guy got 30 years, but I don't think anybody could have done a better job than you did. Because attorneys don't need any more trouble than they've already got, do they? Power negotiators know that you should always try to be the one that writes the contract. When the verbal negotiations are over, it's time for someone to put everything in writing. And the person who gets to put it in writing has definite power in the negotiations. Because there's bound to be half a dozen little details that you didn't think of when you were verbally negotiating that need to be specified in the written contract. If you're the one who gets to write the contract, you can write those to your favor. And then it's up to the other person to negotiate them out when it comes to signing the contract. So try to be the one who writes the contract. I'll say to the other person, look, we need to put this down in writing, but let's not go to a lot of expense on this. I have an attorney on retainer. It won't cost either one of us anything for me to have my attorney do it. Even if I had to pay the attorney to do it, I still think I'd be better off to be the one who's writing the contract. The fait accompli gambit, which is a French expression, which basically means it is done, works like this. Let's say that you've been negotiating for a major piece of equipment with a supplier. You've asked them to send you a detailed proposal that you can show to your banker. The fait accompli is to send the person a completed proposal with the assumption that they're going to accept it exactly the way it's written. So you change the price on the contract to what you want it to be and mail it back to them, and you include the deposit check. Now they've got a decision to make. They can either take the easy route and just accept it exactly the way it's written, although maybe a little less than they wanted to get, or they can come back, reopen the negotiation, standing a chance of the whole thing breaking down, and go through the time and effort of renegotiating with you. So sometimes a fait accompli, particularly if you're dealing with a relatively small issue, a concession of, say, 5% or less, is very effective. Send in the contract, deposit check enclosed with the changes, forcing them to make that decision. The funny money gambit is critical to good negotiating. Power negotiators learn to understand funny money. There are all kinds of ways of describing the price of something. If you went to the Boeing Aircraft Company and asked them what it cost to fly a 747 coast to coast, they wouldn't tell you $52,000. They would tell you 11 cents per passenger mile. Salespeople call that breaking it down to the ridiculous. Haven't we all had a salesperson say to us at one time or another, do you realize you're talking 35 cents a day here? You're not going to let 35 cents a day stand between you and your dream home, are you? Well, good negotiators think in real money terms. We're talking about a real estate acquisition here, and 35 cents a day on a 30-year contract is over $7,000. When that supplier is talking to you about a 5-cent increase on an item, it may not seem like enough to spend a lot of time on until you start thinking of how many of these you buy during a year. And then you find there's enough money sitting on the table to make it well worth your while to do some power negotiating. So when you're negotiating, learn to think in real money terms. Don't let people use the funny money gambit on you. The decoy gambit is used to take the other person's attention away from what is the real issue in the negotiation. This is the owner who offers to give you a large job, providing you can complete it in a 90-day period. You're very anxious to get the job, but realize that a 90-day completion is virtually impossible. But you scramble and complete a proposal with a provision that it be 120 days before the penalty clause kicks in. In the negotiations, the owner finally concedes the 120-day completion, providing you discount the job by 5%. In actual fact, the 5% was the real issue all along, The completion date was just a decoy designed to take your mind off the real issue. You'll recall in the example of negotiating a hotel room in Atlanta, the decoy used there was the fact that they only had twin-size rooms, not king-sized, available. That wasn't the real issue at all, of course. What I wanted to accomplish was a reduced room rate. But that took their attention away from the real issue. Now, a refinement of the decoy gambit is the red herring. This is a decoy, an issue created in the negotiations, that will subsequently be used to trade off for a real issue. The most famous example of the red herring gambit being used was during the Korean War armistice talks. These talks are very interesting to study in retrospect because of the mistakes that were made. During the ceasefire period, it was agreed that neither side would rebuild the airstrips that had been bombed. It very quickly became apparent to the North Koreans that they had made a mistake, because we were still able to fly planes in from aircraft carriers, but they desperately needed to get the airstrips on the north side of the demilitarization zone rebuilt. So here's how they used the red herring gambit on us to get that provision stricken from the agreement that we had made. They had previously agreed with us that on each side of the negotiating team there would be three neutral countries represented. We had selected Norway, Sweden, and Switzerland. They had selected Poland, Czechoslovakia, but had deferred on the choice of the third country. Later on, we found out why they held off making this decision. Because when the airstrip issue came up, they said, well, we've now decided on our third neutral country. We've decided on the Soviet Union. We said, what do you mean, the Soviet Union? The Soviet Union's not neutral. That's a major communist power. They said, yes, but they're not directly involved in this conflict. So as far as we're concerned, they're neutral. Then they went through the same gambit that your children might use on you. They wore us down by constant repetition of the question about the objection. Why would you object to the Soviet Union, they were saying. We would restate our opposition. But we don't understand. Why would that be a problem, they would say. Isn't this a lot like your son saying to you, Dad, why don't you want me borrowing the car tonight? Well, you borrowed the car last night. What's that got to do with tonight? Well, I don't want you out all the time in the car. And finally, they wear you down by just constant repeating of the question. So finally, the North Koreans said, we really don't understand why you don't want the Soviet Union on our team of negotiators, but we'll tell you what. Here's what we're prepared to do. We'll forget about putting the Soviet Union on the negotiating team if you'll forget about this dumb provision about not rebuilding the airstrips. And we ended up trading off a real issue, the airstrips, for a contrived issue, which was their demand to put the Soviet Union on the negotiating team, something they never expected to accomplish in the first place. So look out for this. The red herring is a decoy created to trade off for a real issue later in the negotiations. Consider it any time the demands of the other side don't ring quite true. I used to work for a man who was always using the decoy tactic on me. He would call me into his office and he'd read me the riot act on a particular issue. After I got to know him a little better, I knew that this was not the real issue on his mind. The real issue was something he'd bring up after he'd softened me up with the decoy issue. So be careful that you're negotiating the real issues in the negotiations, not decoys or red herrings. The puppy dog gambit is a very interesting gambit that you'll find used in negotiations. The name comes from a pet store owner who has a little boy who's not sure about buying the puppy. And he says to the little boy, why don't you take the puppy home over the weekend? If you don't like it on Monday, you can bring it back. Of course, over the weekend, the little boy falls in love with the puppy and he's not about to bring it back. In England, as a teenager, I went to work selling televisions at a TV store, and we sold thousands of televisions using the puppy dog clothes. This was in the mid-1950s, at a time when having a television set was quite a luxury. If you had one, you were expected to invite your neighbors in to watch it in the evenings. So we would say to people who couldn't decide on a set, why don't you just take the television home with you, and you can use it for a week or so, and then if you don't like it, you can bring it back. Well, of course, after having the television for a week and inviting their neighbors over to watch it, they weren't about to send it back to the store. What's going on here is one negotiator getting the other emotionally involved in the decision. And anything that you can do to get people emotionally involved helps you draw the negotiations to a satisfactory conclusion. The more they want it, the more concessions they will be willing to make in order to get it. If the owner has a model of their new head office building in their lobby, they're much less likely to change their mind on the project. And change orders are easier to negotiate. Even presenting the owner with a framed picture of the groundbreaking ceremonies, with them standing there holding the silver shovel, can help a lot when they start wondering if they haven't been given the golden shaft instead. This is the reluctant buyer gambit, which we mentioned briefly in Session 1. It would seem fairly obvious that if you approach the seller with enthusiasm, you're not going to get a very good buy. Yet it's amazing how often I see this rule being broken, particularly on car lots. I'll see somebody go onto a car lot and get so enthusiastic and excited about a particular make and model of car. They may pick out the colors, the upholstery, the options. They may even say to the salesperson, "My car broke down today, and I need something to get to work in tomorrow." And then they expect to negotiate a good price. It simply doesn't work like that. Always play the reluctant buyer gambit. Let's say that you're thinking of computerizing your company. You let the salesman come in and make their entire presentation. Let them have all the time that they want. Ask all the questions you can think of. And when they're all through, you say, "Gee, I really appreciate all the time that you've taken on this. You've obviously put a lot of work into this presentation, but unfortunately, it's just not what we're looking for right now." If they're demonstrating Macintosh, you say, "We've pretty much decided to go with IBM." If they're demonstrating IBM, you say, "We've pretty much decided on a Macintosh system." You see their expectations plunging. They start to package up their stuff, and just at the last minute, you say, "Look, I do appreciate you coming in and making a proposal to us. And just to be fair to you, since you have put so much work into it, what is the very lowest price that you would accept?" It's very effective in squeezing people's expectations before the negotiations even begin. Would you agree with me that when you're buying something, the first price you hear is probably not the bottom line? Of course it isn't. The first price you hear is what they're hoping you'll do. Somewhere out there, as the song says, somewhere out there, there's a bottom line, a walk-away price, a price at which they will not or cannot do business. We don't know what that walk-away price is. We've just got to spend some time negotiating with them to see if we can figure out the walk-away price. So there you have the negotiating range, from the asking price to the walk-away price. And when you use the reluctant buyer gambit, they're not going to come all the way down to their walk-away price. But typically, people will give away half their negotiating range when you use this gambit, which gives you a pretty good fix on how far you may be able to get them to go if you persist in the negotiations. The power negotiator always plays the reluctant buyer gambit. It's an attempt to squeeze down the negotiating range before the real negotiations ever start. Conversely, look out for the reluctant seller gambit. I once knew a man who owned a tremendous amount of real estate, but whenever an agent bought him an offer on one of his properties, it was always his favorite property. "Oh," he'd say, "I'm kind of embarrassed about you bringing me an offer on that property. I've done so well with that, I was just about to take it off the market. I don't think it would make any sense for me to sell it at this point in time, and I certainly wouldn't be interested in anything less than the full asking price." But just to be fair to you, since you were nice enough to bring me an offer, what is the very best price that you would give me? Donald Trump sold the St. Moritz Hotel in New York to Alan Bond, the Australian billionaire. If I remember the numbers right, he bought it in 1985 for $50 million and sold it to Bond in 1988 for $81 million. Not a bad return on investment. And I can just imagine Alan Bond making an offer and Trump responding, "Oh, no, not the St. Moritz. That's my favorite property. I was never going to sell the St. Moritz. We plan to put that in trust for our grandchildren. Look, anything else I have is for sale, but not the St. Moritz." But just to be fair to you, since you were nice enough to come all this way with an offer, just to be fair to you, what is the very best price you would give me? And unless you realize what they're doing to you, you'll go from the low point of your negotiating range to the midpoint, or maybe even the top of your negotiating range, before the negotiations even start. Again, we go back to one of the key characteristics of a power negotiator, understanding that the pressure is always on the other side to compromise, just as much as it is on you, but it never appears to be that way. You always think that you've got the weaker hand in the negotiations. Look out for the general who's saying to you, "I've pretty much decided on the sub for that job, but I appreciate you asking me, so just to be fair to you, Why don't you let me have your very lowest price? So be aware of reluctant buyer and reluctant seller. Typically, the pressure is on them just as much as it is on you. Here's the want it all gambit. It tells you that in your initial negotiations, you should always ask for more than you expect to get. Not only because you may get something that you otherwise would not achieve in the negotiations, but the really key issue here is that you're setting up a climate where the other person can win in the negotiations. Inexperienced negotiators tend to want to go in with their very best offer right at the start because they're not confident enough in what they're doing to start with anything less than that. This is your salesperson who's saying to you, I'm going out on this proposal this morning. I know it's going to be tough. I know they're getting bids from other contractors, too. Let me cut the price up front, otherwise we won't stand a chance of getting it. Power negotiators know that in order to set things up so that the other people can feel they won in the negotiations, they should always ask for more than they expect to get. You may notice that in highly publicized negotiations, such as when football players go on strike or the airline pilots, the initial demands that both sides make are absolutely outrageous. I remember being a consultant on a union negotiation once, and I just couldn't believe the initial demands. The demand of the union was to triple the wages of the employees. The opening demand of the company was to make it an open shop. In other words, a voluntary union, which would have the effect of completely destroying the power of the union at that location. But the initial demands in these types of negotiations are always way out. Then they work their way in towards the middle. They find a common ground, and then they both call a press conference and announce that they won in the negotiations. An attorney friend of mine, John Broadford from Amarillo, Texas, once tested this theory for me. He was representing a buyer of a piece of real estate, and they had a fairly good deal worked out. But he thought, I'll see how this want-it-all gambit that Roger taught me works. And he dreamt up 23 paragraphs of requests that he would make to the seller. Some of them were absolutely ridiculous. He felt sure that at least half of them would get thrown out right away. What actually happened was the seller of the property took strong objection to one of the sentences in one of the paragraphs. Even then, my attorney friend, as I taught him, didn't give in right away. He held out for a couple of days before he finally reluctantly conceded. And even then, when he only gave away one sentence in 23 paragraphs of requests, the seller felt that he had won in the negotiations. So always leave some room to let the other person have a win. I call it the want-it-all gambit. If we're going to ask for more than we expect to get, the next question would have to be, how much more than we expect to get should we ask for? This is the bracketing gambit. Bracketing tells you that your initial demand should be an equal distance on the other side of your objective in the negotiations as their initial demand. Let me put some numbers to that and it'll make more sense to you. The equipment dealer is asking $30,000 for the vehicle. Your objective is to buy it for $25,000. You should make them an opening offer of $20,000. That sounds awfully low, doesn't it? They're asking $30,000 and you've got the nerve to offer $20,000? But that positions your objective of $25,000 midway between the two opening negotiating positions. Of course, it's not always true that you're going to end up at the midpoint, but boy, is it a good assumption to make if you don't have anything else on which to go. This is where people get into trouble in a negotiation like that. The dealer is asking $30,000. The buyer's objective is to buy it for $25,000. But he doesn't have the nerve to offer less than 24, and he can't understand why he ends up paying 27 when the power negotiator can get it for 25. But there's a danger here, and the danger is that you can go in with your ridiculously low offer and scare the other side off by being too forceful. If you go in with your initial offer and say, look, I'm going to make you one offer for the equipment and one offer only. Here it comes, take it or leave it, $20,000. They're liable to be so offended by such a low offer that you won't even get the negotiation started. My advice is to go in very, very low but imply a flexibility in the offer. I would suggest that rather than go in with even a $25,000 offer, take it or leave it, you're better off to go in with a $20,000 offer but imply flexibility. It's a ridiculously low offer, but because you're implying flexibility, they have a tendency to think, it sounds as though we can get him up from that. Why don't we spend some time and see if we can get him up to a reasonable price? It's a better way to get the negotiations started. The split in the difference gambit. Although we Americans love to think of splitting the difference as being a fair solution to a problem, power negotiators know that splitting the difference does not mean splitting it down the middle. The rule is never offer to split the difference yourself, but always encourage the other person to offer to split the difference. Let's say that you've been working on getting a remodeling job, and you've been able to get the owners of the property up to $80,000. And you've come down to $84,000 with your proposal. Where do you go from there? Here's the way you do it. You say, well, I guess this is just not going to fly. It seems like such a shame, though, when we've spent so much time preparing this. We'll talk later about how people become more flexible in relationship to the time that they've invested in the negotiations. We've spent so much time on this proposal, we've come so far down the road, and it seems like a shame that it's all going to collapse when we're only $4,000 apart. If you keep stressing the time that you've spent on it and the small amount of money that you're apart on the issue, sooner or later the other people will say, look, why don't we split the difference? You act a little bit dumb saying, let's see, splitting the difference. What would that be? I'm at 84, you're at 80, 81, 82. What you're telling me is that you'd come up to 82, is that what you hear you saying? Well, yes, they say. If you'll come down to 82, we'll settle for that. And you say, 82 sounds a lot better than 80. Tell you what, let me talk to my partners, or whatever other higher authority you set up. Let me talk to my partners and see how they feel about it. I'll tell them you came up to 82, and we'll see if we can put it together now. I'll get back to you tomorrow. The next day you get back to them and you say, boy, are they tough to deal with right now. I felt sure that I could get them to go along with 82, but we spent 2 hours last night going over the figures again and again, and they're absolutely convinced that we can't come out if we go a penny below 84,000. But golly, we're only $2,000 apart on this thing now. Surely we're not going to let it all fall apart when we're only $2,000 apart. And if you keep that up long enough, sooner or later, they'll offer to split the difference again. I was once negotiating with a bank that had a blanket encumbrance over several properties that I owned. I had sold one property out from under the blanket. They were entitled to a $32,000 paydown of the loan. I offered them 28. I got them to offer to split the difference at 30. Over a period of weeks until this fourplex closed, I was able to get them to offer to split the difference again at 29 and at 28.5, and finally they agreed to $28,250, simply doing what I'm telling you here. So the rule is never offer to split the difference, but always encourage the other person to offer to split the difference. Let's talk about the principle of concentrating on the issues. Have you ever watched tennis on television and seen a highly emotional star like John McEnroe jumping up and down at the other end of the court? You wonder yourself, how on earth can anybody play tennis against somebody like that? It's such a game of concentration, it doesn't seem fair. The answer is that good tennis players understand that only one thing affects the outcome of the game of tennis, and that's the movement of the ball across the net. What the other player is doing doesn't affect the outcome of the game at all, as long as you know what the ball is doing. So in that way, tennis players learn to concentrate on the ball, not on the other person. When you're negotiating, the ball is the movement of the goal concessions across the negotiating table. It's the only thing that affects the outcome of the game. But it's so easy to get thrown off by what the other people are doing, isn't it? I remember once being interested in acquiring 18 fourplexes, a large real estate project. But I knew that I had to get the price down way below the $1.8 million that the sellers were asking for the property. It was owned free and clear by a large group of real estate investors. A real estate agent had brought it to my attention, so I felt obligated to let him present the first offer, reserving the right to go back and negotiate directly with the sellers if he wasn't able to get my $1.2 million offer accepted. The last thing in the world the agent wanted to do was present an offer at $1.2,600,000 below the asking price. But finally I convinced him to give it a try, and off he went to present the offer. He made a tactical error here. He shouldn't have gone to them. He should have had them come to him. You always have more control when you're negotiating in your power base than if you go to their power base. But anyway, he came back a few hours later, and I said, how did it go? And he said, it was awful, just awful. I'm so embarrassed. I got into this large conference room, and all of the principals had come in for the reading of the offer. They had hired their attorney to come in, and their CPA, and their real estate broker was there. And I was going to do the silent close on them, which is to read the offer and just let the next person who talks lose in the negotiations. The problem was there wasn't any silence. I got down to the $1.2 million, and they said, "Wait a minute. You're coming in $600,000 low? We're insulted." And they all got up and stormed out of the room. I said, "Nothing else happened?" He said, "Well, a couple of the principals stopped in the doorway on their way out, and they said, 'We're not going to come down to a penny less than $1.5 million.'" It was just awful. Please don't ever ask me to present an offer that low again. I said, "Wait a minute. You mean to tell me that in 5 minutes you got them to come down $300,000 and you feel badly about the way the negotiations went? See how easy it is to get thrown off by what the other people are doing rather than concentrating on the issues in a negotiation. It's inconceivable that a full-time professional negotiator, say an international negotiator, would walk out of negotiations because he doesn't think the other people are fair. He may walk out, but it's a specific negotiating tactic, not because he's upset. Can you imagine a top negotiator like Richard Burt showing up in the White House and the president saying, 'What are you doing here? I thought you were in Geneva negotiating with the Soviet Union.' 'Well, yes, I was, Mr. President, but those guys are so unfair. You can't trust them, and they never keep their commitments. I got so upset I just walked out.' Power negotiators don't do that. They concentrate on the issues, not on the personalities. Where are we now compared to where we were an hour ago or yesterday or last week? That's why salespeople will have this happen to them. They lose an account. They take it into their sales manager and they say, 'Well, we lost this one. Don't waste any time trying to save it. I did everything I could. If anybody could have saved it, I would have saved it.' And the sales manager says, 'Well, just as a public relations gesture, let me give them a call anyway.' And the sales manager can hold it together, not necessarily because he's any brighter or sharper than the salesperson, but because he hasn't become emotionally involved with the people the way the salesperson has become. Don't do that. Learn to concentrate on the issues. Always maintain perspective when you're negotiating. Don't get so carried away with the thought of getting an extra nickel or dime that you lose sight of the really key issues in the negotiation. Always be thinking to yourself when you're negotiating, how will this look a year from now? How does this fit into the scheme of things? You see, sometimes people get so enthusiastic about power negotiating that they're negotiating just for the sake of negotiating. That's fine when you're negotiating little things just for practice at negotiating, but when you lose a big job because you got a little bit too greedy, then that's a big mistake. Maintain perspective when you're dealing with people. Don't get so carried away with negotiating that you lose sight of the real issues that are important to you. When an issue is laid on the table, there are always two thoughts to consider. The first thought should be, is this big enough to spend the time negotiating on? How much money would I be making on a per-hour basis? And the second thought is, will this show up on my bottom line at the end of the year?
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's tape. Feel free to give us a call with your comments, or if you prefer, you may fax or email our office. Better yet, check out Granting Associates on the World Wide Web. Our website provides a detailed schedule of coming full-day seminars. Our address is www.grantingassociates.com, and it is also printed on the tape insert. Again, our website address is www.grantingassociates.com. By the way, don't forget to sign up for Granting Associates' three-day program called the Basic Business Boot Camp, designed for trades company owners and managers. The program involves 3 days of intense business training designed to teach contractors all the basics of labor pricing, cash flow, and service agreements. The tuition includes the latest version of Granting Associates' industry-leading software program called Labor Pricing for a Profit with Cash Flow Projections, which each contractor will use to model his or her company throughout the 3-day program. Enclosed is a 4-page brochure giving all the details. Each class is limited to 15 contractors, so call soon to reserve your spot while space is still available. The Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.